Good morning. We're delighted that you're here this morning. If you are visiting the class and haven't been here, we're going through the Old Testament, but we're doing it a little different than you might typically have it done in a Sunday school class. We're going trying to really dig into not just the scriptures themselves, but some of what scholastic work has produced, some of what archaeology has shown us, and trying to pull in some different disciplines. So I hope you plug in. I hope you enjoy it. All of our lessons are online if you find it interesting and want to go back and catch some stuff you haven't caught so far. Now, growing up, I have a distinct memory as an eighth grade boy sitting out. I was sitting back about two-thirds of the auditorium on the left-hand side, in about two seats from the aisle of the Broadway Church of Christ in Lubbock, Texas. And as I was sitting there, the preacher was Joe Barnett, and he was preaching a sermon. And in the process of preaching the sermon about the disciples' inability to cast out a demon, Jesus then cast out the demon. The disciples say, "How come we couldn't cast out the demon?" And Jesus' response was, "Truly I tell you, if you have faith as small as a mustard seed, you can say to this mountain, move from here to there, and it'll move." Now, as an eighth grade boy sitting there, eighth grade is a grade where you play competitive athletics, perhaps. Eighth grade's a grade where you're learning that the more you work out, the more you become looking like some of y'all. You know, it makes you cut, it makes you built. And as an eighth grade boy, the way my brain was, I thought, I don't have enough faith to move mountains. I mean, I can't say to a mountain, "Would you move from there to there?" and have it happen. So I thought faith might be like any other muscle, and maybe I just needed to work it out. So I thought I'd start by trying to move pencils. And once I got to where I could move pencils, I'd just gradually get more and more faith till finally I could move mountains. Now, I'll confess, I don't remember anything else about the sermon, because I think I spent the rest of the 30 minutes that Sunday night staring at the little pencil in the pencil holder in front of me with the little contribution envelopes, trying really hard to believe that that would move. It didn't. So I was not able to move a mountain. I wasn't even able to move a pencil. Now, that does not count as moving a pencil. That's twirling it on PowerPoint. That's moving the picture of a pencil. But I couldn't do anything at all. And I thought, how terrible is my faith? And I really wanted to grow, and I wanted, and I prayed, "God, would you give me more faith? I'd like to be able to at least move a pencil." Well, I learned something in life as I grew up past eighth grade. And I learned that as your faith grows in the Lord, and typically it grows through trials and tribulations and times of struggle, that's when it's worked out or exercised. And I learned that as those trials and troubles and struggles work, and as your faith is placed in the Lord, whether it's the struggles of an eighth grade boy, or the struggles of a young man, or the struggles of a middle-aged man, or the struggles of... I turn 51 in a few weeks, and I'm really concerned about age. What do I call myself now? I'm not old, am I? I guess I am. My daughters say an old man. I've learned that as you struggle through the crises of life, if you struggle through them with faith, those crises, whether they're the size of a pencil or the size of a mountain, are moved by faith. I'm not simply spiritualizing what Jesus said, but I'm absolutely convinced that there is a way. When I was a younger adult, I faced a time of crisis in life that I'm absolutely convinced was something I never saw coming. And it's one that I couldn't understand where it was coming from. It just didn't seem right to me. God should not have put this here. I mean, I wasn't walking in disobedience. I was trying with all of my heart to follow the Lord. And heaven knows I wasn't perfect, but I was, you know, I didn't see how I had brought this on at all. It just seemed dumped in my lap. And it was a crisis of great magnitude that affected me. It affected my family. It affected my life. And I had some choices I could make. I could either say, well, how could God let this happen to me when all I'm doing is trying to serve Him? Or I could say, there must be no God, for surely this is an injustice. This crisis is not fair. Or I could humbly say, God, I'm lost. I'm walking through a deep, dark valley with shadows of death. And I'm scared, and I don't know what's coming. But I'm going to hold your hand as tightly as I can and pray that you will get me through, that you will move this crisis. And it didn't happen overnight, and it didn't happen in a week, and it didn't happen in a month. It took over a year for God to move through that mountain for me. But He was faithful to do it. And I thought that through because I thought about crisis and what do we do with crisis in our life? And how do we handle crisis? If crisis is a mountain, what do we do? And it's appropriate in this week because what we've done is last week we finished the fall of Samaria, the fall of the northern kingdom. This week we're going to look at crisis, look at the big mountains that need to be moved in crisis. But we're not going to look at crisis in terms of just us. We've focused on Israel before. Now we're going to the southern kingdom of Judah. And we're going to focus on the crisis that happened there, specifically with King Hezekiah, in response to the big threat of the day. The big threat of the day was the superpower Assyria. And we saw how Assyria had grown to be the largest power, the largest imperial, the first imperial power, but the largest power the world had ever known. And it had threatened and taken over so much of the Middle East. What happened in Judah while all of this happened? Well, King Hezekiah is our key. We look at him in crisis. And when we do that, I want to give you the overview that the prophet historian put in 2 Kings. This is an overview of his reign. Look at 2 Kings chapter 18 with me. We'll look at the first seven verses together just to get an overview. This says, in the third year of Hoshea, son of Elah, king of Israel. Hoshea was the puppet king that the Assyrian king had put into place. Hezekiah, the son of Ahaz, king of Judah, began to reign. Ahaz was the Judean king who had paid Tiglath-Pileser from Assyria money as a vassal so that Tiglath-Pileser would come fight against the northern kingdom of Israel and the kingdom of Damascus. And if you remember all of that, that helps us in time here. So Hezekiah was 25 years old when he began to reign. He reigned 29 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Avi, the daughter of Zechariah. That's important because your Jewish lineage is always traced through the mother. He did what was right in the eyes of the Lord, according to all that David, his father, had done. Now, his father, Ahaz, did not do that. This is an about face from his dad. Dad wanted to placate the Assyrians, so he even shut in the temple worship of Yahweh and brought in idols and worshiped the gods of Assyria. Unlike his dad, this is when the rebellious stuff of youth is useful. He removed the high places. He broke the pillars. He cut down the Asherah. Those are the poles that were used to worship the goddess Asherah. He broke in pieces the bronze serpent Moses had made. Because until those days, the people of Israel had made offerings to it. That was the serpent out of bronze Moses made and lifted up in the wilderness so that the people could look upon it and be cured of the sickness. He trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel. Look at that word, trusted. He trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel. You're going to want to remember that word. That word in the Hebrew is batach. Okay? Batach. He trusted. Those of you who are visiting in this class, we've learned the Hebrew alphabet, so we have to throw it in every once in a while. All right. He trusted in the Lord, the God of Israel, so that there was none like him among all the kings of Judah after him, nor among those who were before him. This is the most profound statement made about any king of Judah. You think, well, what about King David? King David was a king of the united monarchy, both Judah and Israel, before the division, as was Solomon. But once the division took place, we are now at the king, none like him among all the kings of Judah, after him or before. Why? Because he held fast to Yahweh. He did not depart from following him. He kept the commandments that Yahweh commanded Moses, and Yahweh was with him wherever he went out. He prospered. He rebelled against the king of Assyria and would not serve him. He struck down the Philistines as far as Gaza and its territory, from watchtower to fortified city. So that's the overview of who we have, if we can go back to the PowerPoint. So in overview, we're looking at a king who loves the Lord. He's tied in. His heart is with God. He's faithful. He trusts in the Lord. He follows the commandments that God gave through Moses. And he prospers. And yet he has a crisis of monumental proportions. Actually, he has more than one, but one that we'll look at this week. And so when we look at it, if we look at Hezekiah's crisis, we've got to see where we draw our information from. Because we're looking thematically at a crisis. We're not simply walking through the text. And we can learn about the crisis some in 2 Kings, but we can also learn about it in 2 Chronicles. Because the chronicler wrote about it as well. Chronicles written later than Kings. You can read about it through Isaiah, who's one of the prophets. Isaiah's been prophesying for decades at this point in time. He's an older prophet, but he's still alive, and he's prophesying during the life of King Hezekiah. We can look at it through archaeology, because there are archaeological discoveries that are very important and help us better understand the biblical stories. We can also look at it through the records of Assyria, because the enemy that Hezekiah faced was a very good record keeper. And so we've got some really good records that talk about this from the Assyrian perspective. After Pastor Fleming's message, we want to be fair and balanced. So we'll listen to the Assyrians as well as to what Hezekiah said. So that's what we're going to do. Now, here's the way we're going to look at it. Here's the way we're going to look at his crisis. His crisis was a military crisis as well as a personal crisis. And in November of 1959, the United States government, Joint Chiefs of Staff, got together, and as a result of their study, they prepared a defense alert status for our nation. It's still in use today. It's the DEFCON list. And so there's DEFCON 5, DEFCON 4, DEFCON 3, DEFCON 2, DEFCON 1. Highest the U.S. has ever come, DEFCON 2, happened twice, both sort of related to the Cuban Missile Crisis. DEFCON 5 is just normal readiness. This is just the way we're always ready. DEFCON 4 means there's a problem. We're increasing security. We have legitimate security concerns. DEFCON 3, more than that, we're now getting ready. This is the medium readiness, but we're getting ready because we think something's coming. DEFCON 2, the worst the U.S. has ever been, we're ready for war. This is the very next step to nuclear war, because DEFCON 1 is nuclear war is imminent. We're facing it. And that's the alert system that is used with the U.S. government. So with that in mind, let's take our alert system and let's look at what happened with Hezekiah. Hezekiah starts out in normal readiness. He's at DEFCON 1. DEFCON 1 is one, well, let's hold on for a minute. Let's look at it this way first. Or DEFCON 5, not 1. Thank you. DEFCON 5. When Hezekiah takes over, normal readiness, he's going to be king. He's not doing things the way his dad did. He's doing it much better. He cares about the Lord. So we're going to start in 2 Chronicles chapter 29. And Hezekiah begins to reign. 29:1 says he began to reign when he was 25 years old. He reigns for 29 years. In verse 3 we read, in the first year of his reign, in the first month, and this is the first 30 days of taking office, he opened the doors of the temple, the house of the Lord, and he repaired them. He brought in the priests, the Levites. He got them in the square on the east, and he said to them, listen, I want you to consecrate or dedicate yourself. Make yourself clean. Set yourself up holy. Consecrate the house of the Lord, the God of your fathers. Carry out the filth. That would include the idols. The filth from the holy place. Our fathers have been unfaithful and have done what's evil in the sight of Yahweh our God. They've forsaken him. They've turned away their faces from the habitation of Yahweh. They've turned their backs. This is what's gone on before. Now, Hezekiah had lived to see what happened to the northern kingdom. If he's 25 when he takes the office, he had lived, he had seen it, he was aware of the prophecies and saw the prophecies coming true of the northern kingdom being ransacked because of its unbelief and its idolatry and its sin before the Lord. So he cleanses the temple. What else does he do? He restores temple worship so that they start worshiping the way they're supposed to worship. What else does he do? He celebrates the Passover. It hasn't been celebrated in a long time. Now remember, the Passover is the feast, not simply a feast. It's the ceremony. It's the ritual that honors God delivering the Israelites from Egypt. Now this is at a time when Judah is paying a tribute to Assyria, and Judah is in bondage to Assyria. Do you think something clicked in their brains when for the first time in their life, likely, they're celebrating the Passover where it's detailed, here's the way God miraculously delivered into freedom our nation, our forefathers. Here's the way the Paschal lamb was sacrificed. The door is on the lintel, and on the doorpost of every home as the angel of death passed over. And the Israelites were brought into the promised land where promises, covenant was made, and promises were made. And so they celebrated the Passover. Interesting to me to read how this was done. Hezekiah sent to all Israel and Judah, because there were residual people still living in Israel at this point in time who were Jewish. Well, Jewish is not the right word, who were Israelites. Whether that means that they just hadn't been caught up in the deportation, or whether they fled to Judah and then went back home after the deportation and resettlement, we don't know the details. But you've got northern kingdom Israelites that he's including, all Israel and Judah. He wrote letters to Ephraim and Manasseh that they should come to the temple at Jerusalem to keep the Passover. And look what happened. So they decreed to make a proclamation throughout all Israel, from Beersheba to Dan. Dan's at the very top. That the people should come and keep the Passover to Yahweh, the God of Israel, at Jerusalem, because they hadn't kept it as often as prescribed. So couriers went throughout all Israel and Judah with letters from the king and his princes. And the letters said, people of Israel, return to Yahweh, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Israel, that he may turn again to the remnant of you who have escaped from the hands of the king of Assyria. Turn back. Come back to God. So they celebrated the Passover. Didn't do it perfectly. Hezekiah prayed that God would look at their heart, even when their actions didn't nail it just right. God honored that prayer. Then Hezekiah starts organizing the priests. When all of this was finished, all of Israel who was present, everyone who came in for the Passover, they went out to the cities of Judah, and that's when they broke in pieces the pillars. That's when they cut down the Asherim. That's when they broke down the high places. That's when they smashed the altars. Throughout all Judah, Benjamin, Ephraim, Manasseh destroyed them all. They went out and they cleaned the landside from idolatry and items of worship associated with anyone other than Yahweh God, who through Moses delivered the people from bondage. This was life at DEFCON 5. And it's understandable they did it because they were honoring not only what Moses had told them to do, but the promises of Moses that were in the law that went along with the instructions on the Passover. The promises said, if you faithfully obey the voice of the Lord your God, being careful to do all his commandments that I command you today, the Lord your God will set you high above all the nations of the earth. Now, you're suffering under Assyria's thumb, and you find out if you faithfully obey, if you're careful to do, that God will set you high above all. Hezekiah believed it. If we are to look at a map of Assyria, and you'll have to excuse my hand drawing, but if we are to look at, let's see if we can do that a little better. That's kind of a map of Assyria. Y'all sort of see that? You remember the Isaiah prophecy about Assyria? Assyria at the time of Tiglath-Pileser, before the prophecy, is bordered by the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. That's Assyria. And Isaiah prophesied that Assyria was going to overflow the borders of the waters and would reach like a flood down into all of the lands. And sure enough, up into Urartu, down into Babylon, into the western countries, and down into the southwestern countries, overflowing the borders until before long, by the time of Hezekiah, this is the border of Assyria. And here, nestled in this little bitty place right about here, is Judah. Okay, you don't see Judah, do you? I got to do that to let you see Judah. Because Judah's just not too big. Judah's there. Oh, you've got the Philistines here on the coast. You've got old Israel was up here, a little bit north of there. You've got Tyre and Sidon and the Phoenicians up in here. And so this is what Hezekiah decides. He decides, hey, I don't have to pay my taxes. God says, if we go back to the PowerPoint, if you faithfully obey, being careful to do, that God's going to set you high above the nations, and I'm doing that and the people are doing that, we've destroyed all the idols, we're okay, we're getting out of here. And he quits paying his taxes. He rebels against the king of Assyria. Now he chooses to do it at a time where, let's go back to my PowerPoint map. He chooses to do it at a time where Assyrian records indicate to us that Babylon down here, Babylon is also, let's see if we can do it this way, Babylon is also rebelling against Assyria. So we'll put Babylon in blue because they're going to be crying soon. Babylon in blue is rebelling against Assyria, and Assyria is having to fight them. So, hey, the army's down there a few hundred miles away. We'll rebel over here and quit paying our taxes. And Hezekiah, we get from the Assyrian records, doesn't do it alone. He forms a coalition. First of all, he goes to the Philistines and says, hey, join me in this. The Philistines say, we're not going to join you in this. So he conquers at least one of their kings, Padi, P-A-D-I, conquers him, gets his own king put in place, so the Philistines join him. He gets the king of Tyre, Sidon, to join him. He gets the Damascus ruler to join him. And so he's got a coalition of people, and they're all saying, now's the time we're going to stand up against the might of the Assyrians. And so the Assyrian king Sennacherib says, I'm going to do something about that. It's called go to war. And he takes his army, and as soon as he mops up where he is in Babylon, he starts marching. At this point, it's DEFCON 4. And DEFCON 4 is one where the king, by the way, let's try that again. Thank you. DEFCON 4. See, I'm sure they got something like that in the White House when it like changes levels. I'm not quite sure what theirs sounds like, but I'll send them this on an MP3 if they see it on the internet and want it. Now, DEFCON 4, Second Chronicles and some Assyrian records are where we need to go to understand what happened here. In Second Chronicles, it sets out what the king himself was doing. And it does so if we start with 2 Chronicles 32. Sennacherib's coming in. He's got his army ready to go. And, of course, Hezekiah is in Jerusalem. So when Hezekiah saw that Sennacherib had come and intended to fight against Jerusalem, he planned with his officers and his mighty men to stop the water of the springs outside the city. And they helped him. A great many people gathered. They stopped all the springs and the brook that flowed through the land. Why should the kings of Assyria come and find much water? He didn't want people to realize how good he had it. So they went out and they stopped up. You see, Jerusalem's built up on a mountain, on a hill. They would call it a hill. I'm from Lubbock. To us, it's a mountain. But it's built up on a hill, on a mountain, and it's up on a limestone rock. It's if you've been to the old city of Jerusalem, that's where it is, and there are springs that come out of the limestone rock. Well, they basically block up and stop up all those springs, and then he set to work resolutely, and he built up all the wall that was broken down. He raised towers on it. Outside of it, he built another wall. He strengthened the Milo in the city of David. He also made weapons and shields in abundance. He set commanders over the people. He gathered them together at the square, and he told them, he gave them the pep talk. He said, be strong and courageous. Don't you be afraid. Don't you be dismayed before the king of Assyria and the horde. That's like Hebrew for massive army that is with him. There are more with us than with him. Now, not in people. Because with him, it's an arm of flesh. But with us, it's Yahweh our God to help us and to fight our battles. And the people took confidence from the words of Hezekiah, king of Judah. So, DEFCON 4. He starts getting ready. If we go back to the PowerPoint. In 2 Kings, it adds this passage. The rest of the deeds of Hezekiah, how he made the pool and the conduit and brought water into the city, are they not written in the books of the annals of the king? What Hezekiah did is he started getting ready for battle. And this is like King David. He's, in a sense, a man after David's heart. David's a man of faith. He knows God's going to slay Goliath, but how many stones did he take? Okay, just in case God didn't use the first four, he's still got one more. Okay. Just because God's going to do it doesn't mean God does it apart from us. God's going to help Adam and Eve take care of the world, but he tells them to do it. God tells us to do things, but he puts his spirit inside us because he uses us and does it through us. We're an integral part. So was Hezekiah. Now, this is a passage that if you go back and you read commentaries before 1899, a number of commentaries say that this is a fictitious thing. That the idea that Hezekiah made a pool and a conduit and brought water into the city, we know that not to be true. This is an example of the Bible just making stuff up. And then in 1899, they discovered Hezekiah's tunnel. And it's the length of about 6 football fields. And it does, it carries the water. In fact, if you go to Israel today and you pay the money, I think it's like $10, you can wade through it because it's still got water in it. And it's a tunnel that, in fact, about one-third of the way in the tunnel, there was a plaque that they finally discovered. They didn't discover it when they discovered the tunnel because it was crusted over some with mineral deposits. But it's a plaque that talks about how they built it. And they were building it in a hurry because they were facing war. And the plaque doesn't mention King Hezekiah, but it's written in the script, the way they wrote script here in the 8th century B.C. in the 700s. So we're at about 701. And it says that they were building the digging the tunnel through the soft limestone from both sides at once, trying to meet up in the middle. And where they met, you can see, because they were off a few feet. So there's a real sharp turn there. But they were working desperately to put it together, and the archaeology shows it. Not only that, but if we look at, let's see, do I have another picture? You counted that Isaiah. I love this prophecy out of Isaiah. So many times we think those prophets just read stuff that don't make sense to us. They make sense if we understand them for what they were written for, including the prophetic element of the future. But Isaiah, who was the prophet alive during this time, one of the prophets, said, "You counted the houses of Jerusalem and you broke down the houses to fortify the wall." He's talking about Hezekiah. When Hezekiah built that extended wall, where did he get the stone from? He tore down a bunch of houses inside Jerusalem to do it. And you can find the remains of his wall at various places of Jerusalem now when you go there and start looking. So he took the stones from the houses, and you can find pottery remains and all sorts of things that help date these things. And he builds the wall because here's the hope. The hope is that while the Assyrian is trying to take care of the mess in Babylon, they would ignore Judah's rebellion. But the reality was they would not. And so down they come. He's increasing security. He's at DEFCON 4, but the crisis worsens. His crisis moves to DEFCON 3. DEFCON 3. 2 Kings says it this way, in the 14th year of King Hezekiah. Now, he's had 13 years since he did all of those reforms. For 13 years, they've been following the Lord. For 13 years, they've been celebrating Passover. They've had the priests. They've smashed the idols. They've been obedient. They've been making the claim. Name it and claim it. Deuteronomy 28:1. In the 14th year of King Hezekiah, Sennacherib, king of Assyria, came up against all the fortified cities of Judah. That's all, remember, in our Hebrew sense or in the Greek sense, means all within the category of what he's talking about. It doesn't mean every single solitary one, as the story will make clear. All the fortified cities of Judah and took them. Sennacherib gives the detail as well. Here's the way at DEFCON 3, as he's getting ready to come to Jerusalem. Here's the way it's told in Sennacherib's writings. Let's see if we can get this up here. Mordecai Kogan is who has translated this for us, or anybody else who wants to spend the money for his book. And what this Assyrian record does is it just charts how the king of Assyria, Sennacherib, went south, and he took out the Phoenicians, and then he came down and he took out the Philistines, and then it talks about Ekron, who had thrown their king Potty. Who had been a proper vassal of Assyria, they threw him into iron fetters and they handed him over in a hostile manner to Hezekiah the Judean. Well, that's what we had read about in Kings. See, this is the Philistine king at Ekron. So the Philistine king, Kings said that Hezekiah had defeated the Philistines. He had, but he had defeated a Philistine king who was a vassal of the Assyrians. So the guys are mad. The Assyrians are mad. They come in and they wipe out that, and they freed Paddy the king. And look what he says about Hezekiah. "As for Hezekiah the Judean, I besieged 46 of his fortified walled cities and surrounding smaller towns which were without number, using packed down ramps, applying battery rams, infantry attacks by mines, breaches, siege machines," maybe it should be translated storm ladders. "I conquered them. I took out 200,150 people. That's an exaggeration. That's called preacher's count. There are thousands of y'all here today. No. But it was an acceptable thing to do because these were written to brag on the achievements of the king of Assyria. So it was just accepted. Everybody would look at it and say, take off a zero. Took out 200,000, 150 people, young and old, male and female, horses, mules, donkeys, camels, cattle, sheep without number. I counted them like spoil. He says, I did the same thing. I took out, let's go back to the PowerPoint. I took out all of these surrounding towns. And Sennacherib's records show it. Now, let's move from DEFCON 3. Things get worse for Hezekiah. His crisis elevates to DEFCON 2. No, I'm staying at DEFCON 3 for a moment. I didn't tell you about Lachish. We have time for Lachish. Lachish was the second most important, second largest city in the southern kingdom of Judah. It was a gateway between the Philistines and Jerusalem. If you were going to attack Jerusalem from Philistia, you'd have to go. The roads went by Lachish. So it was this big, walled city that was built up and fortified like no other city in Judea except for Jerusalem. This is what it looks like from an archaeologist today. If they're going to dig it, it's still much overgrown. But they've been able to pull out areas. They've dug out the gate, the outer and inner walls. Now, here is a reconstruction from archaeologists of what it looked like because Sennacherib went and he besieged it. It's one of those cities that he specifies that he went up and attacked. And so it's the second most, it's the city he's cleaning the clock of on countdown to Jerusalem. He's fighting his way to Jerusalem. And you can see from the reconstruction of the assault, what they did is they built up dirt ramps. They took up, it's hard to see. I'm sorry we're missing our big screen. But I'll tell you one thing I did. I brought a book of Sennacherib's sculptures that are in the British Museum that were found in his palace at Nineveh. And if anybody wants to look at these afterwards, I'll leave it down here, but it gives you great pictures. They brought in their battering rams that had room for the archers to be shooting the arrows from the rams themselves. They built the ramps, and they went up, and they attacked it, and they assaulted the city. Here's a relief from one of the drawings. What the king did, what Sennacherib did, is he had all of this engraved in stone, chiseled into stone, and put it right behind where he would sit on his throne in Nineveh, in his palace. That's how proud he was of taking the city of Lachish. And it shows you, you can see the towers where the Israelites are fighting, but you can see in the lower left-hand corner going up that looks like a brick path, which is the embankment they did. That's the battering ram going up, trying to go and attack. And then coming out of the gate are the slaves from conquering it. Here's another artist's reconstruction of it in a diorama of what it would have looked like while they did it. Now, he not only did this, but he took many of the leaders and he impaled them on stakes alive. This is shock and awe. And this is what Hezekiah is getting word back on. And this is where Hezekiah goes, I may have bit off more than I could chew. Have you ever done something you thought was right before the Lord and then things weren't going too well and you thought, maybe I messed that up? Might not have heard it quite right. So Hezekiah sends a message to King Sennacherib. Here's what it says. My bad. Oops. My mistake. Mea culpa. I have done wrong. Withdraw from me and I'll pay you. So Sennacherib demands every dime, in essence, that Hezekiah's got. Hezekiah's stripping the gold and the silver from the doors of the temple. He's taking everything out of his treasury. He sends it all to Sennacherib. And I'd love to tell you that as a result, Sennacherib was happy, but he wasn't. He took it all and then said, now I'm coming for you. DEFCON 2, the next step to nuclear war. I'll use one of John Monson's maps here because it's got a great three-dimensional view and shows you the mountains. You'll see Jerusalem with the green circle up at the top, up in the mountains. You'll see down the Shephelah, the lower hill area, and then the coastal plains is down at the bottom. If we went further on the bottom, we'd have the Mediterranean Sea. So the left side is the north side. So coming from the left of this picture, the blue arrow, these are the towns that are recited by Sennacherib as the way he went to go about his duties. So he goes and he attacks Lachish, and then he goes to Libna, and he's just getting closer and closer to working his way inland to Jerusalem. And that's the next step, is Jerusalem. It's nuclear war is imminent now for Hezekiah, and we read about it in touching ways. We're getting close on time. We've got to go through this quickly. I urge you to read more of it on your own. But here's what we've got in 2 Kings 18. Here's the write-up. The king, 2 Kings, it starts with verse 17. The king of Assyria sent the Tartan, that's his commander-in-chief. By the way, whoever wrote this, the prophet historian, he nailed exactly the titles and the job responsibilities of the chiefs of the armies of Sennacherib. And I put the citations in there for you from the Assyriologists to show you how dead on this is. The Rabsaris and the Rabshaka. The Rabshaka was the chief cupbearer, but that doesn't mean he was a cupbearer. He actually was the head of part of the military forces. And a great army from Lachish now went to King Hezekiah at Jerusalem. So they send a big army. They don't send the whole army because they've still got a great army down there at Lachish. But they come to Jerusalem, they arrive, they stand by the conduit of the upper pool on the highway to Washer's Field. They were right outside the walls. They called for the king. So the three generals of the Assyrian army come in. Hey, Hezekiah, come on, come to the wall. Well, Hezekiah is a king. So he doesn't come to the wall to meet his adversary's three generals. He sends three of his guys. Says, I'm a king. Your king didn't come to me. I'm not coming to you. I'll send three guys. So out come Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, Shebna, and Joah. So the Rabshaka, the cupbearer, says, the general says to him, you tell Hezekiah, this is what the great king, the king of Assyria, says. On what do you rest this batach, this trust of yours? Do you think words are your strategy? In whom do you trust? So he asks first, on what do you trust? And then he says, in whom do you trust? You trust in Egypt? They're like a broken reed. You lean on them, you get cut. You trust in Yahweh? You think Yahweh is going to save you? Heavens, Yahweh is the one who sent us. Because you took down all of his worship places in the high places. That was a dead giveaway. The Assyrians didn't understand Yahweh and Yahweh worship. Because Yahweh worship only one God. Yahweh would never be upset because they tore down the Asherah poles based on the idea that Asherah must be the wife of Yahweh. They knew better. So, in whom do you now trust? So, I love this. This is very real to me. So, Eliakim and Shebna and Joah, they yell down the wall, hey, talk to us in Aramaic. We understand Aramaic. Don't do Hebrew. All the people can understand what you're saying. You know, we don't. And the response of the general is, hey, do you think my master sent me to speak these words only to Hezekiah and not to the men sitting on the wall who are doomed with you to eat their own dung and drink their own urine? And he says it in the language for all those men to hear. They're at DEFCON 2. You're thinking, that's DEFCON 1. Oh no, it gets worse. If you'll read through the paper, you'll see how much worse it gets, or better yet, go read the scriptures. Hezekiah says, okay, someone needs to go find Isaiah and tell Isaiah that they're making fun of God and they're making fun of us, and Isaiah needs to pray to God and figure out what's going to happen. So goes to Isaiah. Isaiah sends back word, don't worry about it. The king of Assyria is not going to come into Jerusalem. You're protected. God's going to fight your battles for you. And there was some measure of solace there. However, if they were at DEFCON 2, the three generals went back to find King Sennacherib, and when they did so, we walked into DEFCON 1. Nuclear war is imminent. I want to tell you how Sennacherib saw it, but before I do it, I want to tell you the biblical story, and I really would like you to have time. This time, Sennacherib sends a scroll. He sends a letter that says, hey, this is your last chance. You know, you want to live and just be deported and be dethroned, fine, but you want to be totally annihilated and killed and impaled like everybody else, you just keep on doing what you're doing. And Hezekiah this time doesn't send the scroll, the letter to Isaiah saying, pray for me. Hezekiah takes it into the temple and he prays himself. And when he prays, Hezekiah says, Lord, the God of Israel, enthroned above the cherubim, you are the God, you alone, of all the kingdoms of the earth. You've made heaven and earth. Incline your ear. O God, save us, please, from his hand, that all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you, O Lord, are God alone. And then Isaiah came to Hezekiah and prophesied the fall of Sennacherib and said, Sennacherib will not just die, but he'll die by the hands of his sons, which he did. Sennacherib came and he sieged Jerusalem. The siege lasted for over a year. And Hezekiah is stuck, and Hezekiah, but Hezekiah and the people withstand the siege. And when things seem darkest, the angel of the Lord comes into the camp of Assyria and in one night wipes out massive numbers of troops. Some doctor scholars believe, by the way, that it was an outbreak of the plague and that this is the first historical reporting of a plague outbreak, bubonic plague, but we don't know enough to know. There is a massive death overnight. And then Sennacherib hears a rumor, and between the death and the rumor, he heads home. And it's just a matter of time before some of his sons that he passed over for being the next king assassinate him. And he's gone. Now, if you were to go to the museum in Israel, you would see this. It's Sennacherib's cylinder. And in it, Sennacherib writes up what happened. And he talks about taking all of these different cities, and he talks about all the spoils of war that he got. But how does Sennacherib put political spin on the fact he was never able to conquer Jerusalem, that God saved Hezekiah at DEFCON 1? He puts political spin on it. It's really fun to read. Here's the way it reads. As for Hezekiah the Judean, I locked him up within Jerusalem, his royal city, like a bird in a cage. I surrounded him and made it impossible for him to leave. So there. I put him in time out for like 2 years. And then I just decided, that's enough. I'm going home. That's called political spin for a losing king. And then Sennacherib claims his spoils and booty, the spoils of war from the conquering of the little cities in Lachish. He claims that Hezekiah gave him that. So be it. So, where's your life in crisis? Are you at DEFCON 5? Things going pretty good. DEFCON 3. Are you at DEFCON 1? Is nuclear war imminent in your life? I don't know. But I can tell you this, that if you've got a mountain of crisis in front of you that needs to be moved, the way to move it is by trusting in the Lord. Because faith can move mountains. Points for home. In the overview of this story in Kings, the prophet historian of Kings writes, he trusted in Yahweh, the God of Israel. I can remember as a four-year-old child singing a song I learned at church. I didn't know what the song meant. I just thought it had a catchy chorus. Mom, you're out here. You can probably remember me singing this song, walking around the house. Trust and obey. For there's no other way to be happy in Jesus but to trust and obey. It starts with trust. Jesus to Jairus says, Jairus has just found out his daughter's dead. Don't bother the teacher anymore. Your little girl is dead. Jesus says, don't fear, only trust. It's the lesson of Hezekiah. Don't trust. Batach in Hebrew translates into pistuo in the Greek. It means believe, trust. You don't fear, you trust the Lord. You're at DEFCON 1. Don't fear. Trust God. Trust Him. He will not let you down. Point for home 2. He held fast to the Lord. He kept His commandments. That's the other part of the song. Trust and obey. If you're at DEFCON 1, 2, 3, 4, or 5, you put your trust in the Lord and you diligently work to do what God wants you to do, because then you're in His will and nothing can come against you victoriously. Now, that doesn't mean you may not be like Paul in prison, wrongly. Paul says, even if I suffer death, look, the church, the early church, was built on the blood of its martyrs. But even in the martyrdom of those early Christian saints, God was there. Stephen gets a vision of Jesus as he's being stoned and killed. God will not let you down, regardless of your crisis level. Because that's point for home 3. The Lord was with him. Wherever he went out, he prospered. God is trustworthy. I want to pray with you before we leave, but I want to give you your want more. If you've got a crisis in your life, I would love to pray for you. And the only way I can do it in a class this size is if you'll email me. You can email me at wantmore. That only goes to me and Steve Taylor and Dale Hearn. If you want it just private with you and me, and you don't have to sign it, you don't have to do anything. Just tell me what your crisis is, and I'll pray for you. I'll commit to do that. I would be honored to do that. So email me. I've got a private email I can give you as well if you don't want anyone else to see it. But I would be honored to pray for you. Would you pray with me right now? Lord, we come before you, gathered together as family. And I know in a class this size, we've got people at every level of crisis. And I want to pray, Lord, for each one of us, that we will seek you out in faith and trust, that with childlike obedience, we will follow as best as you empower us to do it, Lord, your will. And where we fail, Lord, that we confess our failures and repent and allow your restoration process to wash over us with your blessings. Lord, we honor you. In Jesus' name, amen.